Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, we bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead. My name is Duduzile Ramela, in for Jeremy Maggs on this third day of October. Here's what you can look forward to. It's Cancer Awareness Month, and we speak to a radiologist on the importance of early detection. We look at trade credit insurance for businesses in the face of rising liquidations. We also speak to Jeff Wicks, who's a journalist with News 24, an investigative journalist. He will speak to us about the Tembisa Hospital graft report by the SIU. And we also take a look at the playbook for community scheme governance. R2 billion. That is a figure that has captured South Africa's attention this week as the special investigating unit known as the SIU more widely revealed its investigation into corruption at Tembisa Hospital in Ekurhuleni has uncovered three coordinated syndicates responsible for the looting of over R2 billion meant for healthcare. Jeff Wicks is an investigative journalist with Media 24. He has done extensive work on this and has also written a book more so about the killing of Babita Diokaran, you remember the whistleblower. Jeff, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. So the SIU says it's currently probing allegations to Tembisa Hospital and has to date identified three major syndicates that have misappropriated that amount meant for healthcare at Tembisa. It further goes on to say an analysis of 2,207 procurement bundles has revealed serious maladministration and procurement fraud. Is this confirmation of the information that you have already put out there for those who have not read the book?
Hi, Dudu. Yes, absolutely. This is complete vindication, not only for the book, but for the work that we've done over several years at News 24 into the malfeasance at Tembisa Hospital. I think the way to frame this in the listener's mind is that Babita Diokaran was essentially the genesis of this report. She is the one who started it all, because she was the first to see the first shades of this extraction network operating at Tembisa Hospital. And now this report, which was released earlier this week, gives us a real sense of the depth of it and how not only three main syndicates were able to launch an incursion into the hospital, but nine syndicates in total were able to take root there. And I mean, that's a damning indictment on the probity of the Gauteng Department of Health. But Babita had seen the signs 4 years ago, and now we finally have confirmation that she was bang on the money.
Let's look at these three syndicates for now. The Maumela Syndicate, please detail that for our listeners.
So the Maumela Syndicate is quite an interesting one. It's obviously headed by Hangwani Morgan Maumela, who's nephew to President Cyril Ramaphosa from a previous marriage. And that syndicate, we had placed 21 separate entities in his orbit during our investigation. The SIU obviously was able to go further with their powers of intrusion and place that figure at about 41 different companies. So that's what we've been looking at in terms of the Maumela Syndicate. And obviously a lot of money was steered towards purchasing assets. And, in total, that network of companies was responsible for pulling out more than R820 million from that hospital.
And we take a look at what the SIU says here. It says the asset forfeiture unit identified assets linked to Maumela, which has resulted in the NPA's asset forfeiture unit preserving some of these assets, including properties listed in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 provinces, motor vehicles that are listed here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 vehicles. So this preservation, what does that mean? How should we understand this?
Well, I think we should understand it in two ways. Firstly, I think it's a significant milestone in the criminal investigation, because an asset freeze is obviously a usual signifier that something more serious is headed Mr. Maumela's way. But what should also give us pause is the fact, just the crude arithmetic of it. So he's responsible for pulling out 820 million rand from the hospital, and they've preserved assets worth 320 million rand. So there's a 500 million rand discrepancy, nearly half a billion rand, in terms of what the NPA has been able to find and then freeze. So there's a lot of money still missing, and I think that's a significant issue when you compare the two parallel investigations, that of the SIU and then the NPA.
Let's take a look at the Mazibuko syndicate. Please help our listeners make sense of that.
Of course. So Rudolf Mazibuko essentially headed what was a medical supply dynasty, which had, saw its heyday from Tembisa Hospital. There were 17 entities that we identified in that syndicate, which were all controlled by his family members. One company was even controlled by his brother, and it's located in Christiana, far away in the Mpumalanga province. So, you know, that was a red flag for a proxy directorship, but they're responsible for again, several hundred million rands extracted from the hospital. They are also responsible, or that syndicate rather, is also responsible for some pretty significant price inflation that we were able to find. And one good example is a heavy-duty plastic bucket. And they, one of the companies in that network, sold four of these buckets to Tembisa Hospital for about 40,000 rand, when in fact those buckets are really only valued in extreme cases at more than 200 rand each. So that gives you a visceral real world example of how these prices were contrived and inflated to be able to pull the maximum amount of funds out.
Sure. And then there's Syndicate X. Why is it called Syndicate X and it doesn't have a particular or particulars of the individuals involved?
So as we understand from the press briefing, there seems to be some reluctance on the part of the SIU to name Syndicate X. During our investigation, the three syndicates we identified, the only one we haven't spoken about is one that was run by Stefan Joel Govind Raju. And his syndicate was immense in the sense that, you know, even in our investigation, we were able to tie 60 separate shell companies to him. And he was really a fantastic puppeteer at the top of this racketeer enterprise that is responsible for more than 600 rands of extraction. So, I mean, I keep flippantly throwing out these figures worth several hundred million rand, but the true depth of this thing, I believe, we've not yet seen. This is only an interim report from the SIU, and if my suspicions are correct, then we'll see the number in terms of cash extraction still rise.
Because then the question probably in a listener's mind is what happens now, right? Do we take a look at the procurement system in the country in terms of public procurement? Do we take a look at, you know, what now? Because you also touched on the fact that this is good news in terms of the NPA doing its prosecutorial work, but we know that the NPA is also crippled, et cetera, et cetera. Then what?
I think there's a couple of pretty obvious, you know, paths forward for us. Not that there'll be the political will to pursue them, but I think one, and probably the most important one, is modernizing our procurement system. The extraction at Tembisa was only able to happen because the entire value chain in terms of the people actually running the procurement system had been bought. We know that because of the amount of kickbacks traced back to Gauteng health officials. And bear in mind, we are in 2025 and we still operate on a paper-based procurement system. You know, those loopholes have been kept in place intentionally because they allow for the extraction to take place. If we had a modernized online portal for procurement, there would be further checks and guardrails in place. But in this instance, they're not. And we know why, because, you know, in nearly all of the orders which were channeled towards these syndicates, fake documents were used, documents which had been tampered with, BEE certificates which had expired, tax clearance certificates which had expired. And that was all overlooked because it was a human being doing the overlooking. If we had a robust system to replace the human beings, we would not have had this issue, or they would have had to go to far more extreme lengths to get what they did right. So that's one issue. And then obviously the second issue is we need to understand that the protection of whistleblowers is important. Babita Deokrand sacrificed her life to report wrongdoing because this, in essence, what it was 2 billion rand being removed from the benefit of the patients at Tembisa Hospital and being channeled to a very select few individuals who became extremely wealthy from that facility.
Jeff, thank you so much for your contribution this afternoon. Jeff Wicks is an investigative journalist with Media 24 as well as an author.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's take a look at the Community Scheme Ombuds Service. In July, it issued a consolidated practice directive. This supersedes all prior directives. It applies to sectional title properties and is the playbook for community scheme governance. Mervin Dorosamy is Regional Ombud for the Community Schemes Ombuds Service. He joins us to take a look at this. Thank you very much, sir, for your time this afternoon. What were some of the most notable changes or additions?
Thank you, Dudu, and good afternoon to the listeners. Thank you for having me and CSOS. Certainly, as you mentioned, we've now consolidated the practice directives. It's all in one. So it's not completely new rules. It's existed for somewhat 8 years. We've refined them and made them more readable and understandable. But I think that if there's any confusion out there, we invite them, the stakeholders in community schemes, which are these complexes and estates, to contact us for any clarity. And we are also unpacking the practice directives at our next conference, which is called the CSOS Indaba on the 23rd and 24th at River Sands Four Ways in 23rd, 24th of October. So we invite stakeholders to join us there online or in person. The more notable ones are, of course, penalties. We believe that you can't impose penalties without notice or warning. And these transgressions have to be looked at very carefully when imposing penalties, because owners can contest the penalties. And then we're also saying that if someone has outstanding levies, you cannot prevent them from voting or participating unless a court order or an adjudication order has been obtained against them. Then we saw that there were rules. You see, all of these rules come to us as a regulator for us to quality assure. And then we pick up on these rules and we don't approve them if they are fall within our category of undesirable rules. Mm-hmm. And it's an undesirable rule to prevent consumption of food on common property. But the use of alcohol and intoxicating substances may be prohibited. But also we found a more common one. Domestic workers were prevented from talking to each other and not walking, or prevented from walking on common property without a name tag. Those rules are undesirable, and we will not approve a scheme's rules in that regard. Mm-hmm. For example, also vehicles. Vehicles parked unlawfully cannot be towed away. The owner of the vehicle needs to be penalized, and other remedial action can be taken against them. The more controversial one, of course, is the slaughtering of animals. These rituals for cultural and religious mm-hmm. purposes cannot be prohibited. They must take place under strict conditions, and we set out the conditions in page 88 of our practice directives. You know, the giving of notice, the qualification of the person doing the slaughtering, and all of those things. So those requirements must be met. If those requirements are not met, then the governing structure can prevent the ritual taking place. And then we've also seen common, what's happening more recently is the disconnection of water and lights because mm-hmm. someone is in arrears with their levies. Now that's prohibited unless the scheme or the trustees follow due process and obtain a court order. The lights and water cannot be disconnected or limited or restricted in any way whatsoever. So those are the more common ones, we believe. And, you know, it always relates to pets, penalties, and also the conduct of people. Those are not new. They've been there, but we've refined them for more clarity.
And the rule on the use of cannabis? Anything new?
Yes, so we have legislation, and we know that the Constitutional Court has ruled on that. And so the private use and private growth of cannabis cannot be prohibited. And so we are encouraging schemes to obey the law itself. Sometimes we just simply restate the law. Our practice directives are based on a number of legislation, but primary of which is the Constitution. And so if we restate it, then it's simply what's prevailing law in that regard. Ah. But of course, the use of the cannabis can become a nuisance to the adjacent neighbor. And when that happens, then the unit owner can complain to CSOS and lodge a complaint regarding the conduct. And, you know, the necessary proof will need to be brought forward.
Understood. You do have a stakeholder that has raised an issue on the access to scheme information. So it says the CSOS's directive that it's that owners rather submit applications for information in terms of the Public Access of to Information Act when they want to see, for instance, the body corporate's bank statements or accounts. What is the understanding of that issue brought up by that particular stakeholder?
Yes, certainly that the view is incorrect, because what we want people to do, firstly, the exchange of information must take place at the schemes. Unit owners are entitled in terms of the legislation to a certain information at AGMs and at all other given times, subject to POPIA and subject to other regulations or legislation. And it must be determined by the information officer at the scheme and by the conduct rules there. Now, CSOS is not the regulator for PAIA, P-A-I-A, the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Mm-hmm. The information regulator is. But we can simply restate that in the context of community schemes. And we're saying that many people come to CSOS for access to information. And we are urging trustees and governing bodies of schemes, estates, sectional title developments to consider the request very carefully. We are urging that all schemes must have internal dispute mechanisms. So first you try it out there. You know, when you are unable to get the access to information, you apply to us. Now, this is where the sharing of information, and we're asking, you know, you don't have to be secretive about information or keep certain information or redact certain information unnecessarily, or say to schemes, you know, or owners, you're not entitled to that. You know, you can go to courts. That's unnecessary. The legislation provides what you're entitled to, whether it's annual financial statements at a certain point or juncture, and other information as well. But also, it's important to share that information when somebody wants to bring. So, for example, if you are unit owner number 10 and you want to go against number 11, but you don't have details, you can make that request to the scheme governing structure or to CSOS, so that you can enable that dispute to go through. Because if you don't have contact details of the other person, then there's some difficulty.
Thank you so much for helping us. There's definitely more to unpack around this. But for now, we say thank you to Mervin Dorosamy, Regional Ombud for the Community Schemes Ombud Service.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So at some point in our lives, or those of our loved ones, we would have come into contact with radiology. And we highlight this because October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And in November, the month after this, the world will mark International Day of Radiology. And in anticipation of this, we look at the importance of radiology in a patient's healing journey. Dr. Peter Schub runs Africa's first internationally accredited breast imaging center of excellence. That's Park Lane Radiology. He joins us to look at this critical profession. Doc, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Maybe let's start with some definitions. How should we understand radiology? Who and what is a radiologist?
Right. Good afternoon. Hi. Thanks for having me. Okay. So a radiologist is a specialist doctor, and really our specialty involves imaging of the body. In other words, taking things like x-rays and scans of different areas to try and identify disease and help the treating doctors to determine the best therapy for the patient. And it's got quite a wide array of modalities, from x-rays to ultrasound, CT scans and MRIs, and even interventional radiology. So that's really the field that I'm in. I focus particularly on breast radiology, where we look at diseases of the breast, most importantly cancer, both in terms of diagnosing it and assisting the treating doctors to treat the condition.
We'll get into breast radiology in a few moments, but in 2022, the largest representative body for radiology worldwide, that's the American College of Radiology, granted full accreditation to Park Lane Radiology as Africa's first and only breast imaging center of excellence. What was the qualifying criteria?
So essentially, the American College of Radiology is the largest representative body of radiologists in the world. It's got something like 40,000 radiologists who are members. And they set the criteria for radiology centers in order to ensure that they meet internationally recognized standards of image quality, the staff qualifications, make sure that the equipment performance is up to speed, and ensure patient safety and quality control. And so basically, you have to make an application and send through proof that your equipment is technically up to the standards, that your pictures are adequate, and that your staff is fully qualified and experienced.
So when you go to a doctor, maybe we can do a case study to sort of demonstrate the importance of radiology. You go to a doctor and they say, go visit a radiologist. I need to see an image of what's going on with your breast, for instance. A patient walks in and what happens?
So in terms of the breast, either a patient is coming as part of a routine screening, right? So screening, basically the mammograms, we're saying that women over the age of 40 should come and have that done every year so that we can pick up cancers, even if they're not aware of any symptoms, as early as possible. And then they would have the mammogram, which is basically an X-ray test, usually followed by an ultrasound of the breast just to make sure we haven't missed anything. But the other possibility is that a woman feels a lump, or maybe her doctor examined her and felt something in the breast and has referred her for further investigation. And again, we'd usually start with a mammogram and the ultrasound to try and find out if that symptom is possibly a cancer.
I recently visited a radiologist for my four-year-old, and the doctor was not happy with the quality of the image. Why is that important in helping a doctor make a determination of what is going on, essentially?
So we have to try and be as accurate as possible when we are doing these X-rays and scans, because, you know, the whole point is that a doctor examining a patient won't always know if what they're feeling is a harmless or benign condition, or possibly something more sinister like a cancer. And so we need to be able to give them that information. And if the image quality, if the quality of the pictures is not good enough, then they can't rely on that. And their ability to effectively treat the disease is going to be diminished. So the quality of the radiology is especially important, and that's exactly why being accredited with international bodies is so important.
On regional or maybe country-specific level, are there bodies that overlook radiology, right? So you've got an internationally accredited, or you've got international accreditation as Parklane, but in South Africa, are there bodies that also ensure that there's good practice that is followed by radiologists in the country?
Absolutely. So in South Africa, we've got the Radiology Society of South Africa, which is the representative body of all radiologists, and they've got subcommittees. So there's the Breast Imaging Society of South Africa that deals specifically with breast radiology and mammograms, and they will also put out various criteria and quality assurance requirements. It's not quite as stringent as the international bodies, but there certainly is some oversight and regulation in South Africa. And to be approved rather than accredited with BISA, that's the one in South Africa, there are also certain equipment and personnel requirements.
Doc, the message is clear, especially for women over 40. Do not wait to feel a lump or to feel uncomfortable. Go visit a radiologist. Have that imagery done so that you are comfortable with what is happening inside of your body. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. But Dr. Peter Shub runs Africa's first internationally accredited breast imaging center of excellence. That's Parklane Radiology.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
So from January to August 2025, business liquidations were 1.5% higher than the same period last year. As of the end of August, there were 1,035 liquidations, and most liquidations were voluntary. These impacted the finance, insurance, real estate and business services sectors rather the hardest. The trade, catering and accommodation sectors were also impacted. That's information according to Statistics South Africa. Coface South Africa argues, though, that that trade credit insurance is a safety net many businesses, particularly small businesses, can benefit from. We'll find out how in a few moments as we speak to Abdul Vali, CEO of Coface. Thank you very much, Mr. Vali, for your time this afternoon. So we understand that 88% of these businesses went into liquidations. They have done so voluntarily and not compulsory. Help us understand, maybe, as we deal with definitions, when we speak of liquidations, what are we talking about essentially?
Okay, so basically, liquidation is when a business is either approached by its creditors because it's unable to pay its debts, mm-hmm. and the creditors would then approach the master's office to get a liquidation order. It's a court order, and that would then, if approved, would result in the business being wound up. So a liquidator would be appointed. They would then basically look at what assets are left in the business, sell off all the assets, and then try and settle as many creditors as possible. Problem with that is, with the liquidation, is in most businesses you've got the banks that have secured themselves with assets of the business, as well as you, then the next in line would be obviously your preferred creditors, which would be us, as well as staff. So employees and SARS would then be in the next line of any collections that may come out of the liquidation. Last is the creditors. So anyone who supplied a goods or service into that business on credit terms that have monies owing to them would then basically stand last in line to collect any residue. So a liquidation is usually the last resort, because you usually, as a supplier to the accredited to that business, I mean, to be quite honest, I think if you get 5 to 10 cents in the rand, you'd be lucky.
Sure. Is this cause for concern when we take a look more so at the data from Statistics South Africa, that over 1,000 businesses voluntarily went into liquidation, or is there nuance to the numbers?
So, yes. So there is some nuance, right? So, for example, if two businesses decide to combine and they transfer the operations into a single entity, but depending on how they want to structure it and what's the most cost-efficient and tax-effective way, you may end up with a business with no assets, and then there's no point in keeping that business going, because there is some cost incurred to keep that entity going. So then they would maybe approach the IPC to wind it up. They would then liquidate it, because it's a cost-effective way to close off that business. So in that instance, no one really takes any losses, because there are no assets or creditors in that business.
And then when they take losses, in comes the trade credit insurance. What does it allow businesses to do, more so small businesses?
Perfect. So that's exactly where we become a really important player in the space, because if you are credit insured, depending obviously on your policy, we could pay you up to 90% of what was owed. As long as you've obviously traded within your policy conditions, mm-hmm. you've traded up to the limit that we've approved, you would get paid up to 90% of any amount owing. In most instances, between 7 and 30 days, you'd get paid out. So 7 or 30 days from the date of the liquidation.
That's a fair turnaround, no?
That is, especially with the liquidation order. Even if there was potentially a high residue, the liquidation process could take months to a year, maybe two. To be quite honest, I'm thinking maybe I know of a specific liquidation that occurred in 2014. There are still payments being made now.
Sure.
So it means it was such a complicated, messy process to wind up at this business, sell off the assets, identify all the creditors. It ended up that creditors only eventually got some money after 10 years. The creditors that were insured got paid out within 7 days in most instances. And the nice part is, even with credit insurance, the positive is that if, say, for example, the liquidator gives us 1 rand back, we would share that with our client. Mm-hmm. So we would say, okay, fine, of the 1 rand, you take 10 cents and we'll take 90, because that's the proportion of the claim that we paid out to you.
So when it comes to the contribution that a business makes, right, there's terms and conditions that we all need to be aware of. For you to be able to have that breathing room, what do you need to be aware of in terms of making consistent payments? In which instance would you not pay out? In which instance would you pay out? Is that important?
That is critical, and I can guarantee you that in the entire trade credit insurance, maybe not even just South Africa, globally, the largest reason for us rejecting a claim mm-hmm. would be not submitting the claim in time. And I think that's where businesses need to be quite wise, because what they tend to do is they believe their customers, right? So the customer says, no, I'm going to pay you next month. No, I'll pay you the month after. And they keep stringing them along, and they keep hoping that the customer would pay them. And they're afraid, obviously, to submit a claim, because the moment they submit their claim, it could potentially damage their relationship with that customer. Right. So they keep this hope alive. And unfortunately, in many instances, they pass the time in which they need to submit a claim to the credit, the insurer, and therefore the insurer has to reject the claim. And rightfully so, right? Because in most instances of overdue accounts, the sooner you can start acting on collecting, the higher your collectability. The longer the time, the less you're going to get out. And at the same time, for example, if I've got company A as an insurer, I've insured company A for 5 different suppliers, and one supplier hasn't been paid. Unfortunately, when businesses do become, you know, difficult, when they get into some sort of cash flow difficulties, they would start playing one supplier off the other. So they would run up an account, let it age, and then they would go buy from a competitor, sure. right? And if both of those competitors are insured with us, I need to know that the one account's now overdue, because that will immediately assist me in managing the risk on the entire account. And so therefore, they're basically prejudicing the insurer and the competitor to some extent, because they also have skin in the game. So that's why we encourage our clients to try and maintain the timelines for when to submit a claim, so that we can get in quite early and manage that risk. Okay. And if we get in early, we can put some instances, even assist them, the customer, you know, the debtor that's in a cashless strain. We could say, engage with him and say, okay, what's the problems? How can we help you? Mm-hmm. Can we potentially allow you to trade on a COD basis, or for every rand you pay, we'll give you some credit, so at least the business can get through the problems it has. Or we could say to them, listen, okay, we understand where you are, you know, pay off over the next 6 to 12 months, X amount per week, for example. And okay. It's only through that engagement that we could potentially have a successful outcome. But if we don't have that engagement early on, the likelihood is we're going to end up paying a claim, or everyone's going to end up with a loss.
Sure. Fair enough. Thank you very much, Mr. Vali, for your time this afternoon. Abdul Vali is CEO of Coface South Africa. That's COFACE. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We're here every weekday at noon with your latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. A big thank you to you for making us part of your day. Jeremy Maggs is back with you on Monday, the 6th of October. I'm Duduzile Ramela. Have yourselves a magic weekend ahead. Bagaitsho. Bulekeo.